danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 228 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Valmorin, Quebec, Canada. I am Andrew Brokus, not currently joined by Nate Mavis, who is still on paternity leave, but don't worry, ladies, Nate will be making an appearance during our interview. Guest today is Jose Pachon, probably not a household name in the poker world unless you happen to play in the northeast of the United States, where you may have crossed paths with him at Foxwoods, Mohegan Sun, or Twin Rivers. I'm not sure I ever quite got the name of that casino right. So Jose came recommended to us. We've had a couple of people, who play with Jose recommend him to us, including John the Lawyer, who has been not only an excellent guest on the show himself, but has recommended a lot of the best guests in my opinion, whom we've had on the show, at least not obvious people that maybe other folks haven't heard of, but who turned out to be, in my opinion, really good guests. So was definitely excited to talk to Jose, and he did not disappoint. I certainly had an interesting life. He was born in the 1970s in Colombia, which means that he grew up kind of at the height of the Pablo Escobar. I don't even know what to call it, crisis, fiasco, era, and has some pretty crazy stories from during that time. And so, as I mentioned, Nate joins us during that interview. He was a few minutes late, obviously with a young child at home, it's difficult to, we didn't even know if he was going to be able to join us, but so he ends up joining us 10 minutes or so into the interview, so you can look forward to hearing a bit from Nate. The interview does bounce around a little bit. I didn't do the greatest job of keeping things organized, so we kind of jump back and forth from, talking about Jose's childhood in Colombia to talking about his current poker career and back to Colombia. So if you enjoy the Colombia stories, don't cut out on the interview halfway through, because we come back around to it towards the end of the interview. So as I said, a little disjointed, poorly organized by myself, but very good to talk to Jose, very good to have Nate making an appearance on the show, and I hope that you will enjoy the interview. If you enjoy the show overall, the single best thing that you can do for us is rate and review on iTunes or anywhere else that you find podcasts that you're able to rate and review the show. That's probably the single best thing you can do to help more people hear the show, which is really our goal for it. Whatever little bit of money we make off of the Turn and Poker Edge ad that you'll hear shortly is really a pretty secondary consideration. Our number one goal is just to share the stories of our guests with as many people in the poker world as we can. So, rating and reviewing on iTunes is a great way that you can help, recommending the show to friends, retweeting it if you're on Twitter, or sharing it on other social media. All that kind of stuff is a big help to us, but mostly we just appreciate your listening. If you're interested in poker strategy, Tournament Poker Edge is our recommendation. That's where you'll find videos from myself, from Nate, from many former guests of the show, including the most recent addition to the lineup, Alexander Fitzgerald, a.k.a. Assassinato, someone we've had on the show several times, kind of a legendary poker player and poker coach, and now you have access to maybe not all of his wisdom, but quite a bit of his wisdom. He's only made a few videos so far, but of course we're hoping to see many more from him at tournamentpokeredge.com. Strategy hand today is coming to us from Paul. Paul says, this is from a 1-3 game at his local casino. He says, after sitting down for one orbit, I'm in the big blind in a nine-handed game. Under the gun plus one, middle position, cutoff, button, and small blind, all limp. And I check five of hearts, four of diamonds in the big blind. I think nothing too controversial so far. So we go to the flop with... let's see, we've got 6 players putting in $3 a piece. So we go to the flop with probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 in the pot after some rake is taken out. Paul doesn't tell us exactly. And the flop comes 7-6-3 all diamonds. Our hero holding 5-4 with the 4 of diamonds. So it flops a straight, but you know, in a 6-way pot, it is not that difficult for someone to have flopped a flush, even when you're holding a diamond. So we flopped a very strong hand, but we have to keep in mind that it's not what Matt Janda would call a robust hand. In other words, as the pot gets larger, the amount of equity that you're going to have will go down, right? The stronger of a range you play against, the less good your equity is going to be because you are drawing dead to flushes. And well, I guess you have one out too of a straight flush, but your equity against the flush is pretty poor. So you do want to be focused as you're playing this hand on trying to keep second best hands in the pot. Anyway, Paul says, small blind checks, and I fire $20 into the pot to see if I can build a pot for myself, as well as getting a worse hand to call and possibly an overpair to raise. So let me pause here and say, pursuant to what I was just saying about not wanting to make the pot overly large, I think it's good that Paul has a clear idea of what his value targets are. I mean, I'm kind of going to have to take his word a little bit on how he expects people in his game to play. You know, I don't play a tremendous amount of 1-3. It seems a little ambitious to me to think that an overpair is going to raise you when you bet here, particularly that an overpair without a diamond would raise you if you bet here, right? So if someone had, say, under the gun one limped pocket aces and he now just has black aces and you overbet the flop into 5 people on an all diamond board, that he would raise there with black aces seems ambitious to me. And I think actually I imagine these games are loose enough that, and a lot of people are not that pot size conscious, where even if this is, as I'm calculating, an overbet of the pot, a lot of people aren't going to be that aware of it. It's, $20 doesn't feel like a huge bet in a 1-3 game. I imagine a lot of people will be loose. My general expectation is that these games, the players are going to be loose and passive, meaning that I'm pretty happy if people are calling my bets. I think there's a call with pairs, they'll maybe call with like straight draws, which is pretty bad to call with 9-8 on this board. But you'll probably see people doing it, calling with flush draws, including non-nut flush draws, making a lot of calling mistakes. I would expect that. I would actually be a little worried if I got raised. It's really not that hard for someone to flop a flush. I imagine a lot of these limpers are, these are people who play lots of suited combinations, and with 6 people saying the flop, the chances of someone flopping a flush are not insignificant. So as long as people are calling bets, I think it's fine to be betting large, but I would be a little worried if people started raising. So I'm not sure I quite agree that we're hoping for a raise, but I do think there's a lot of second best hands that can call a bet, and because your opponents are passive, you don't really want them to be doing the betting for you. You would much rather, there's tons of hands like ace, six of spades or something that might call a bet, but may not bet if checked out. So I think we're happy to be doing the betting here. I think slightly overbetting the pot is probably good in these conditions. So I agree with how the hand actually plays out. So Paul does bet $20 into a pot of, I'm guessing, around 18, and under the gun 1, cutoff, and small blind, all call. And as I said, I feel pretty good about that outcome. I think when people are just calling, we can feel pretty good about the hand. I think in particular, we're unlikely to see cutoff or small blind calling with, unless they have like the nuts, or I guess they couldn't have the straight flush, but unless they have an ace high flush. I think a lot of people, rightfully, if they flop something like Jack 10 of diamonds and there's already been a bet and a call, they're going to be concerned about the possibility that someone's out there with the ace or the king or the queen of diamonds, and they're probably going to want to raise. So I'm not super concerned about being beat by either of those two players overcalled. There's a greater chance that the original caller under the gun plus 1, the first player to call, is a little more likely to maybe be slow playing a flush, but we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. I think overall we can feel pretty good about even getting called in 3 spots. There's a number of turn cards we would like to fade, but I think we can feel pretty good about our hand right now. The turn comes the 7 of spades. So now the board is 3-6-7 all diamonds and 7 of spades on the turn. Our hero is holding 5-4 with the 4 of diamonds. This is one of the turn cards that I was hoping to fade. I would rather see the 7-pair than the 3-pair because, you know, people are a little more likely to be playing like 7-6 than 6-3. So the 7 coming out blocks a few more of the like 2-pair combinations we might worry about running into, or, you know, 2-pair that would have just turned a full house. But still, with 3 people besides yourself having put money into the pot on the flop, I think the chance that one of them either flopped a flush or just turned a full house is relatively good. I mean, there's only one ace of diamonds in the deck, so they can't all three of them have that. And, you know, some of the other hands they could be calling with are also kind of blocking each other. Like, if someone made a really bad call with 9-8, that makes it a little harder for someone else to have pocket 8s or pocket 9s or 8-7. It's just with this many people giving action, you kind of have to figure one of them is going to have something that can beat 5-4 pretty frequently. The small blind bets $25 into what is probably now like a $75 pot. Paul says, "This doesn't really scare me, as in the few hands he played earlier, he was overvaluing them. He's also currently drinking." So I think this is a great thing to be aware of on Paul's part. You know, my general analysis of this hand is assuming that, like, small blind is playing reasonably. And, you know, if he just seems very sort of splashy, there to have a good time, drinking, I think we can give a lot less credence to his, like, kind of thinking through what other players are likely to have and what's the best way to play his hand, whether he's beat. I think he just kind of wants to bet when he likes his hand or call when he likes his hand, whatever. So I'm not as concerned once we have this read that he's kind of drinking and splashing around. And I think, so Paul raises to $60. He says he wants to see if he can get all of small blind's chips and also try to give some flush draws a chance to pay as well. And I think raising something here is good. If Paul just calls, then everyone behind, or the two players behind, are going to be getting 5-1 on a call. And it's quite likely that at least one of them is drawing live against the hero. So I think making a small raise here, as Paul does, is good. But my intention would be to stop if anyone other than the small blind gives action to the small raise. Like, I think there's a lot of protection value in raising to knock them out of some hands that are drawing live against us. But I think that if they give action after the $60 raise, we don't really want to be continuing with this hand. It's just too easy to be drawing dead. And now Paul says, "To my surprise, under the gun one goes all in over me for $250. Action folds back to small blind, who calls instantly. Paul says, I drastically reevaluate my hand now. I figure for the small blind to call, he must have at least a flush, if not got lucky with 7-3 or something. Under the gun one must have at least a flush as well. I muck, and since action is complete, they both flip over their cards. Before I tell you their cards, let me give you my the last of my analysis here." I think Paul's analysis is pretty good. And the one thing, I'm not even that surprised that under the gun one is raising. As I said, I think there's a pretty decent chance that he has something here. He was also, of the three players on the flop, he was the one I thought could most plausibly have a flush. I thought, you know, cut off in small blind would be a little more likely to raise if they had flopped a flush. So it's quite conceivable to me that under the gun one either turned a full house or flopped a flush. And when he goes all in here, I think even if we can occasionally put him on a hand that you're currently ahead of, maybe like ace-7 with the ace of diamonds or something like that, I think it's almost always a hand that's going to be drawing live against you, and you will... And when you're behind, you're drawing dead to or drawing to one out against flushes and full houses. So I think this is just a spot where you're going to have to fold. Even if you think that you're somewhat ahead of the small blind's range, I don't think we can expect to be that far ahead of the small blind's range. Like, I would expect him to have at least trips when he's stacking off here. So I think, like, the best case scenario is small blind's drawing live against you and under the gun one is drawing live against you. And there's lots of worst case scenarios where you're just drawing dead. So I think Paul is correct to fold. And I imagine the reason we're hearing about this hand is, as it turns out, under the gun one has 5-4 of spades, small blind has 5 of diamonds, 4 of hearts. So in fact, 3 players flopped a flush here, including Paul, and the other two chopped the pot, and Paul ended up folding what would have been good for 1/3 of the pot. And I think this is just sort of an outlier case. I mean, you can see it's a pretty extreme example to have 3 players all holding the same hand, 5-4. That's not going to happen very frequently, and I think that's about the only way that Paul can have enough equity to call here against both of those players' hands. So even knowing that this could happen, that, like, these players either have 5-4 or the other scenarios that I was talking about, this just isn't that good of a spot Being able to get back one third of the pot here is not enough to make up for all the times that you put your money in drawing virtually dead. So I think it's a good fold by Paul, good analysis by Paul, and just you don't want to be too results oriented. And I think it's a good example of how to sort of check whether you're being results oriented. And I don't mean to say that Paul is. I mean, obviously he played the hand and he was just sort of writing into because he thought it was interesting and wanted our thoughts on the hand. So I'm not saying he never really says that he made a mistake. But I think just in general to try to evaluate like how much, I guess what you should read into the results of a hand. I think it's worth looking at the actual results and saying, well, how unlikely of a result was it? Like, given that now that I know what cards these players had, I would sort of like to play my hand differently. How difficult was it for them to have the cards that they had, or for us to end up in this situation? And here, I think it's quite difficult. Like, this is a pretty extreme case where three players had the same two card combination, and of course, that's not going to happen very frequently. So the fact that it could happen doesn't really change the way this hand should play out very much. This is just sort of like a very low frequency event that happened to occur. And overall, I think Paul still played the hand well and thought about the hand well. So thank you, Paul. Well done. Well played. Thank you for writing. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And let's go talk to Jose Pachon. Well, thanks for joining me, Jose. I think this should be an interesting conversation. You know, I know you a little bit from interacting on Skype, but that's about all. But I feel like any friend of John the Lawyer, any recommendation of John the Lawyer is welcome on our show. So thank you.
No, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, John and I have been spending a little more time together since he's been playing quite a bit in my home casino lately, which is in Rhode Island, Twin River.
Oh, I actually didn't realize that was in Rhode Island. I thought that was a Connecticut.
Nope. It's about 10-15 minutes from Providence, Rhode Island. It's in Lincoln, Rhode Island.
Okay.
So it's really convenient for me.
How long has that been open? I didn't realize Rhode Island had casinos.
So that used to be a dog track, and it's been open for, I think, decades.
Okay.
But they got table games a number of years ago, and they just opened a poker game about 2 years ago.
I see.
So it's fairly new.
And you've been playing there since it opened?
Yeah, since the first day it opened. It was one of the best things that's happened to me. See, I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and I was driving down to Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun, which is an hour or a little over an hour, and as you can imagine, that can put a lot of stress on my time. It's just driving an hour to play and coming back, especially since I've always been the type of player that has played a lot of hours. So driving that much every week was very stressful.
Yeah, and you've got a family, right? So you've got your Skype picture. You've got a kid sitting on your shoulders.
Oh, yeah. I have a four-year-old. I actually... I got married about 5 years ago, and my son, who has been, the best thing that's ever happened to me, it's changed my life tremendously.
Yeah, what's that joke about the difference between a professional poker player and a large pizza? Large pizza can feed a family.
That's very funny.
So you were a professional poker player, I mean, even before Twin River opened.
Oh yeah, I've been playing poker full time for over 10 years now.
Oh wow.
I started playing poker professionally, I think about 11 years ago, which is coincidentally about the time that I met my now wife. So she's never known me to have a real job.
I think that makes it easier, as I was kind of the same way. I was with my current girlfriend. I've been with her since before I started playing poker, and I think it is a little easier on them if they kind of
come up through poker with you rather than having to just kind of like dive headfirst into this insane world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the fact that she saw me play poker, she used to sweat me a lot online, and she used to, you know, I used to explain some of the hands to her and why I did certain things, and she sort of understands why poker is a game of skill and why it's different to some of the pit games and craps and other forms of gambling.
Yeah, so I think understanding the swings involved and that kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. That's very, very helpful.
All right. Well, let's back up a little bit and I can get to know you a bit better. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
So I was born in Colombia, South America. I was born in a smaller city called Armenia, but I lived a lot of my life in the capital, in Bogota.
Okay.
And I think a lot of the most interesting things, I think things that are probably going to have to say are things that I had to endure and I had to live through when I was in Colombia and maybe coming to this country also. I think people interested in that.
Yeah. So what, I mean, I don't want to date you exactly, but what era was it when you were living in Colombia? What decade?
Well, I lived in Colombia until I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I'm 40 now. I'm a lot older than a lot of the poker players around.
So that was like the 70s and 80s you were in Colombia?
Yeah. I was born in 76, and I came here, it would have had to be 92 or something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, from what little I know, I imagine that was kind of a turbulent time for Colombia.
Yeah, it was basically the war that Pablo Escobar probably waged on the government of Colombia was going on when I was living in Bogota, which was really stressful. He actually was putting bombs in public places, and we couldn't go to the mall. When you drive to the mall and you were trying to park your car, there were bomb sniffing dogs, and you had to get out of your car and they had to search your car. And that's the way I grew up. It was kind of normal at the time. It was what had to be done.
Yeah, I guess as a kid you don't have a sense of how bizarre that is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I still thought that it was stressful, but yeah, it was kind of like what you had to do. I didn't think that it was so out of the ordinary as I think now. Mm.
And what were you? I mean, what did your life look like as a kid when you weren't dodging bombs?
Well, a lot of my childhood was spent in the smaller city in Armenia. My parents were divorced when I was a kid, when I was one or two. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my life was spent in the smaller city of Armenia. And I had a great upbringing. I mean, I had a lot of family around. My parents were probably middle class, upper middle class. And, you know, there was nothing out of the ordinary for me. It was just the country that I lived in meant that I had to deal with certain things that other kids wouldn't have to deal with. Mm.
And that was true even in Armenia? I mean, I kind of imagine like Bogota being sort of a center of conflict, but even in a smaller place that was still present?
I don't remember that much because that was when I was a lot younger. One of the earliest memories I have, when I was 8 years old, Pablo Escobar murdered his name was Rodrigo Lara Bonilla, who was the, pretty much what you would say is like the attorney general of the country. Mm-hmm. And I remember vividly sitting on my uncle's bed, and my uncle and his wife were sitting there with their mouths open, almost crying, thinking that the country was going to be in a horrendous war. I mean, imagine the type of shock that people would be in if someone like the attorney general was murdered by some drug dealer. It was, you know, it was horrifying.
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
I'm sorry. So when I was, that is the first memory that I remember of the violence, but I don't remember that much more because I was a kid. I was 8 years old. I remember it more when I was in, when I moved to Bogota, which was in my more my teen years.
So Nate just messaged me on Skype that he's actually available to join us. So sorry to interrupt you, but if he's still here, I'm going to add him.
Yeah, great.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Jose. How are you?
Great, Nate. Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Also, hi, Andrew. It's been way too long.
Yeah, hi, Nate. How's it going?
It's going really well. It's going well. Missed you, buddy.
Yeah, likewise. So Jose was just catching us up. He was talking about growing up in Colombia, and I think where we left off, Jose, you'd just moved to Bogota.
Yeah, I moved to Bogota with my mother in my teen years, and you know, I had a normal life. I went to a private school. My mother worked really hard, and she had her own business at the time. And
what,
I went to
was,
a private.
What was her business?
She used to have a salt distribution business. So what she would do is buy salt from a mine, and they would take it into her warehouse. And in her warehouse, she would mix it with fluoride or whatever they used to mix it with, package it, and sell it to supermarkets.
And so she moved to Bogota in order to do that?
I'm not sure if it was in order to do that, but that's what she was doing at the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were going to school?
Right. My sister and I went to a private school in the north of this city, north of Bogota, and we had a very good education. But everything was normal except for the fact that there were incidents where I had to deal with violence. Mm.
So sorry, Jose, I was starting to ask you if you are aware, if you know, you know, what was the strategy behind Escobar sort of like, I mean, it seems like kind of terrorizing the populace. I guess the sense that I've had sometimes is that a kind of like gang leader or drug lord wants to portray himself as like a man of the people or kind of win the people over to his side. It seems like that, right, at least in your case, was not what was happening.
Well, yeah, what happened was, and I'm not, you know, this is gone just from memory, so, you know, this might not be all exactly accurate, but what happened was that Pablo Escobar and all of the drug dealers, they did not want to be extradited to the United States, because if they were caught and they were extradited to the United States, they wouldn't have any control at all. They couldn't buy any judges. They couldn't, you know, life was going to become really, really difficult for them. That was their ultimate goal, was to have the government not extradite anybody, and they were gonna wage war on the government until they said that they weren't gonna extradite anybody, and until if that happened, they were gonna be able to negotiate surrenders or whatever they were gonna do. But they did not want to be extradited to the United States.
I see. So it was essentially like a terrorism campaign to secure a promise of no extradition.
Absolutely. And I should say this. I think that a lot of people have watched the show Narcos, and they show Pablo Escobar. I like the show too, because I like the stories. I can relate with them. But they show Pablo Escobar as a man of the people and a very charismatic guy. This guy was terrorized the whole country. He's probably responsible for thousands of lives that were lost during this time.
Right.
So I think that people should realize that this guy was not the happy, fun-loving person that the bad government was trying to persecute. He was a terrorist.
Yeah, you know, I haven't actually been to Colombia myself, but I've looked into going for, you know, like Nate mentioned, I'm actually in Canada right now to play online poker, but I've looked into going to Colombia for that same purpose. And when I was reading some things about, I think it was about Cartagena specifically, uh-huh. They were saying, like, you know, a lot of Americans think it's kind of like funny to go and make Pablo Escobar jokes or, you know, joke about cocaine or things like that. And it's at least what, you know, the site I was reading was emphasizing, was that for the people who live there, it's really not funny, and it brings back a lot of traumatic memories.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you look at the news and you see that Pablo Escobar was killed, and you see hundreds of people crying and saying, "We love Pablo," well, these people were very poor people that Pablo Escobar used to hand out houses to. Obviously, these poor people that haven't had many opportunities in life, if this guy's going to give them a house, of course they're going to love him. But 99% of the country absolutely hated this guy.
Was that the impetus for your leaving Colombia? The instability there?
It was one of the reasons. I can go into it if you like me to. It's a bit of a long story, but I think it might be worth it.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so my mother had the business where she was distributing salt, and she had some expensive equipment that in her warehouse that she used to mix the salt and all this stuff. At some point, some criminals basically stole their equipment from the warehouse. The security wasn't that great. They came in from the roof, and somehow they got the equipment out of there. She somehow found out from the neighbors who these people were, and she was supposed to testify on a trial so these people would go to jail. They found out who they were, and there was a trial, and she was in a witness list. And she was approached days before with a picture of my sister and I coming out of school, telling her basically that if she testified, you know,
something's gonna happen.
Obviously the threat is implied that they might kill us or kidnap us, whatever the case may be, but they knew where we went to school. And so that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that also after that, she started having, you know, financial troubles. I mean, sure. I don't think she could afford to replace that equipment. And at some point during the summertime when we were on school, some paralegals and lawyers came into her warehouse while my sister and I were there and started basically repossessing everything, repossessing her computers, her desks, absolutely everything. We were sitting there, and I remember vividly my mother sitting with her legs crossed, basically crying, not knowing what to do from here and not knowing where to go. And my sister, who was at the time probably 13, 14 years old, she said, why don't we just go to the United States? And I looked at her and I laughed. I was like, that's ridiculous. What are you talking about? And basically, that is the start of us planning to come to the United States.
What goes into that? I mean, I don't know how aware of it you were as a teenager, but I mean, I don't think it's as simple as just saying, you know, I want to go to the United States. I mean, what goes into that process of immigrating here?
Yeah, so I think, so what happened was we have a family that's been here for many, many, many years, my aunt and my uncle, and they were nice enough to sponsor my mother. They had asked for her many years before. So my mother was able to have a visa and get into the country that way. We, my sister and I, did not have just the papers to go, so we asked for a student visa until my mother sponsored us, and we were obviously, you know, we went through the immigration process and stuff like that, but we got into the country on a student visa.
Mm. And did you go straight to Rhode Island, or where did you start out in the U.S.?
No, we actually moved to Massachusetts, Concord, Massachusetts. My aunt had a house there, and it was a beautiful community, and it actually was very helpful in me picking up the language, because at the time I didn't know how to say anything in Spanish, in English, nothing at all. But the town where she lived, there was really no one that spoke Spanish. So I kind of was submerged in the language for, you know, for months. And that helped me pick up the language fairly quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's a good way to learn, but at the same time, it must be pretty stressful. I mean, I guess you're going to school and, you know, having to do all that in a language that you don't speak.
Oh, yeah, it was impossible. I walked around my high school for months without even knowing what class was next. I mean, it was awful, but it's kind of like ripping the Band-Aid off. I think it worked out for the best.
Yeah. So during this time, I mean, was gambling on your radar at all? Were you playing skill games of any sort?
Not at all. I played Parcheesi when I was a kid. I played a lot of board games, but I was never, gambling never even entered my mind. I mean, it was never on my radar. Mm.
So there weren't casinos in Colombia?
I think there are now. At the time, I don't think they were, and I just never thought about it. I don't think so.
So how did poker end up on your radar?
I got invited to a poker game on 2004 before the Patriots played the Jaguars Super Bowl Sunday. And I played for the first time and I fell in love with it. And I started playing on home games around town. And that's how it all started.
And that was around Massachusetts, or you were in Rhode Island by then?
I was in Rhode Island by then. I was in Rhode Island by then for a while.
Yeah, and that was like the poker boom year. I mean, that was right after Moneymaker won the WSOP and when it's on ESPN. I mean, that was the time to be getting into it.
Yeah, that was 2004. I think the reason why I got invited to this poker game is because this person had been watching poker on TV and wanted to have a poker game.
Right.
So he invited a bunch of people over to his apartment.
And you just enjoyed it. And I mean, I guess at what point did it become something that you were making money from?
So very early in the home games, I came up with an idea that was basically, I'm going to take $100 and I'm going to play with $100. And if I lose $100, maybe I'll put another $100 up and play some, you know, some other home games. But if I lose, if I keep losing, I'm just going to keep the $100 and try to build it up and play from that money. I didn't know that that was the concept of a bankroll, but I kind of came up with that idea on my own.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of because I didn't limit your losses.
Exactly. I didn't have a lot of money to lose, and I wasn't interested in gambling just for gambling. I liked the game, and if I could make money at it, that would be even better.
Did you make money at it? I mean, did you have to reload that initial 100?
I didn't. No.
nice.
I don't know why, but after the second game I went to, I just decided that I was going to read everything I could about poker. And I did. I went to the store that very next day and I bought like 3 or 4 books and I read them. And I think that put me ahead of the other people that I was playing with, which probably weren't any good anyway. So I think very quickly I became, obviously I had ups and downs, but overall I wasn't losing. Mm-hmm.
And what's your, if she was still around, you know, what was your mother's reaction to this? I imagine it wasn't what she envisioned for you when she's bringing you to the United States. You know, she wasn't hoping that you were going to become a professional gambler.
You know, my mother has always been very, very supportive. And I'm sure she was a little scared of when I told her this, but she was, to her credit, she was very, very supportive. She's always supported me in everything I've wanted to do. And if she was scared or if she didn't agree with it, she didn't really show it. She just said, okay, I guess you know what you're doing and just do the best that you can.
That's nice.
You know, yeah. So I didn't have the troubles that people have with their family when they decide to become a professional poker player.
Mm-hmm. And were you playing mostly in like home games or I mean, at the point where you became professional, were you playing more online in casinos or were you still playing in like private games?
So when I became a professional, basically the reason why I became a professional is because I got fired from my job. So, and I was already making about the same amount of money playing poker as I was working, because I started playing 20-40 limit hold'em at Foxwoods. Mm-hmm. And I was doing really well at that game. I don't remember how long I played that game, but I know I was making plenty of money doing it. So when I got fired, I just kind of shook it off I took a drive to the casino and started playing. And I really didn't know that I had decided to do it. It wasn't a decision to, well, this is what I'm going to do now.
Yeah.
But it was like, well, let me try this for a little while and see what happens. And I'm going to kind of look for a job on the side and see how it goes.
And right. And it's not really too much of a trade-off, I guess, if you weren't working anyway.
Right. Right. Exactly. So it was kind of, the decision was made for me. I didn't really make the decision, and I just kind of let it go at some point.
Were you playing exclusively at Foxwoods?
Yeah, at the time I was playing some home games, and I was because Mohegan Sun had closed the poker room a little bit before I started playing. Mm-hmm. So Mohegan Sun didn't have a poker room at the time, so I was playing only at Foxwoods.
And so it didn't appeal to you to, you know, try to put some money on PokerStars or something like that?
Oh, I did play online. So I don't remember the timeline of this, but I did have months where I only played online. I played on Ultimate Bet and PokerStars. No, not PokerStars. I'm sorry, Party Poker. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember how long after I became a pro that happened.
And that was, has it always been limit hold'em for you?
No, I've 90% of my time playing poker has been no limit hold'em. I haven't played limit poker in a very, very long time.
Okay, so that was just when you started out playing the 2040.
Yeah, I did. I started playing the 2040 because at the time the 1-2 at Foxwoods was $100 buy-in. And for some reason, I didn't like the game. I thought that I would have much more upside in the 2040 game, because it was either 1-2 no limit at $100 buy-in or the 5-5 game at the time, which there were people sitting with $10,000-$15,000 in it, and right. I wasn't comfortable at all, or had the money at all to sit in that game.
Mm-hmm. So, what was the process of getting better at poker for you? Was it just through experience, or were you did you have a coach? Did you study stuff? You read books?
So, like I said, I started reading a lot of books right from the get-go, and I read many, many books. And then for some reason, when I started playing online, I was like, this has to be a place on the internet where they teach people how to play poker. And I started searching and Googling, and I came across Card Runners. And I found Card Runners, and I thought it was the best thing I'd ever found. And I watched so many videos, and I found a huge edge by just doing what people were doing at the time, what people were teaching at the time at Card Runners. I would go to the casino and play in the 5-10 game, and I found a huge edge at the time doing that. So that, in that period of time, that's what happened. After I started getting a little complacent, and my win rate over time, over probably like 5-6 years, started dropping and dropping because games started getting a little bit tougher and tougher and tougher. Mm-hmm. And at some point, probably 4 years ago, I had 3 or 4 months in the Foxwoods 5-10 game where I broke even. And I was really, really frustrated. And it wasn't the fact that I was breaking even. It was the fact that I was breaking even. And I was totally lost in hands. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what the right play was. And I decided to step down to the 2-5 game at Mohegan Sun and start studying and trying to build my game back up and try to get my edge back up, because I thought it was kind of, my edge was kind of disintegrated into nothing. From there, I hired a coach and I started reading again and working on my game, and here we are today.
Well, where are we today? What are you playing now? What's your...
I have been playing for the last couple of years in the 5-10 game at Twin River. Mm-hmm. With a lot of success. And that's where I am right now.
So that decision to step down to 2-5, was there embarrassment surrounding that? I mean, did you have in mind, you know, I'm sure you were going to know people in that game who were like, hey, how come you're not playing the 5-10? I mean, did you worry about having to answer questions like that?
Yeah, I was embarrassed. I probably shouldn't have been, but I was embarrassed. And I probably the reason why I went to play in the 2-5 game at Mohegan Sun and not at Foxwoods is because I didn't want to hear all the dealers saying, oh, no 510 today, or all the regulars saying, oh, you're not playing 510 today.
Right.
So it was pretty convenient to move to Mohegan Sun, which was 10 minutes down the road. I knew a lot of the same players, but it was easier to step down in that way. But I was embarrassed, and I probably shouldn't have been.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree that you shouldn't have been, but I also, you know, certainly know the feeling of any time you leave, even if it's just for a single session, just walking away from a bigger game to go to a smaller game, there's always some, I know the emotion that surrounds that.
Yeah, it was tough, but at the time, to be honest, I was really desperate in the fact that I didn't know if I had an edge anymore, and I was lost in hands, and I didn't know what I was doing anymore. I was just... I had let it go too long before I worked on my game again. I just kind of just went on autopilot for like years, right. And I was winning money anyway, so I didn't have a reason to work hard.
So better to be embarrassed than broke.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So I mean, when. I guess what has your split been between online and live poker?
So, I played months on end online without like going to the casino. I also was playing live, and when I stepped up to play 510. I didn't think I needed to play online anymore because my edge was bigger. I thought my edge was bigger and I could make more money playing 510. Mm-hmm. I probably played about 20 to 30% of my hands online, playing six max, like mid-stake six max.
And that was all pre-Black Friday?
It was all pre-Black Friday.
You weren't tempted to move to Colombia and play online?
I have been tempted to do that many times, but it hasn't been the right time. And I don't know, I think it would be a very big change for my wife, even though I think she would be happy to do it. She's mentioned it a couple of times, mm-hmm. But it hasn't been the right time, and I never pulled the trigger on it.
Do you miss Colombia?
I do, but at the same time, because I've been here so long, I met my wife here, I had my son here, I feel, it's strange to say this, but I kind of feel more at home here now, even though 90% of my family is there.
But your mother's still here and your sister?
Yes, my sister lives in New York and my mother lives right here in Providence.
That's nice having her around with the grandson.
Oh yeah, it's very helpful and it's great. It's really nice to see my mother interacting with my son. It's a really incredible experience.
Did his birth overlap with the time when you were struggling, in the 5-10 game and having to move down to 2-5? You know, where did he come into the picture?
I think he came in. He was born when I was playing 2-5 at Mohegan Sun. It was before he was born that I started sort of struggling, mm-hmm. and I decided to move back down. And that was also part of the reason why I moved back down. I didn't want to take more risk than I needed to when I had a son on the way.
Right. That's what I was going to ask. Did you have anxiety around that? Of not only am I now going to have to support myself, but my son as well playing poker.
I never had anxiety about that because I've had my struggles, I've had my downswings, but I've always sort of gotten through it. I never thought that I wouldn't be able to provide for him. It was obviously another responsibility, but I never thought that I would not be able to provide for him.
And it's still going well now at Twin Rivers, it sounds like.
Yeah, I've actually had probably one of the best years of my career. So I've been very lucky, obviously. It's not that I'm some poker playing genius, but as I'd like to think. But yeah, I've had a very good year, and hopefully it'll continue to go from here.
Well, it's not about genius, it's about discipline. I mean, I think just the being able to essentially suck it up and move down when that's what you need to do. I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that makes one successful as a professional poker player, willingness to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think discipline is probably my best attribute as a poker player. I have a schedule where I leave my house at 9 o'clock and I come home at 6. I have breakfast. I help my wife get my son ready for school, and then I come home at night to have fun with my wife and son. And I think that helps me stay grounded and stay aware of what's important. When in the past, when I was younger, if I get stuck, I was at the casino for 24, 36 hours until I got unstuck.
Right.
I think I'd like to think that I've grown out of that, and I've grown into that role of more of a disciplined poker player, I think.
And that 5-10 game goes during the day, that you can just sort of show up and play whatever hours you want to play?
Yeah, it actually, we started at 10 o'clock pretty much every morning. 90% of the mornings, it starts at 10 o'clock, and then it goes every day.
It's pretty convenient that's one of the big challenges, especially for, you know, live poker and trying to keep a normal family schedule, is often poker hours don't coincide with normal working hours.
Yeah. I've been very lucky that wherever I've played, there's always been a poker game during the day. So yeah, I mean, having a casino 15 minutes away from my house, it literally has changed my life.
Yeah, that's pretty great, that being that close to where you work.
Right.
Well, I have a sense, Jose, that there might be some good stories out there that I just don't know to ask. Is there something I should be asking you?
Well, I do have some good stories about my time in Colombia. I don't know if you're interested in that. I don't know if the audience would be interested in that.
I mean, the audience can stop listening now if they're not, but I am. So.
Well, when I was in Colombia and I was 13 years old, I was living in Bogota, and one night I was, you know, doing what I do on the weekend and laying down and watching TV, and my mother and my sister on my side. My mother's boyfriend at the time came in the house and asked what my grandfather's name was. And I said, his name is Bernardo Pachón. And he said, he was just kidnapped this morning. My grandfather, when I was 13 years old, was kidnapped for money, for ransom. And it was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to endure.
Jeez.
There are many stories surrounding that, including that my father was the person who negotiating with the captors. And when I was probably, I don't know, 22 years old at his house, he has a diary, and I read up all about it. I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to tell this story in a very coherent way. So I don't know if you have any questions about it, I think I'll be happy to answer them, but I'm not a great storyteller. So if you have any questions about it, I'll be happy to hear them.
Sure. I mean, it was your father's father who was kidnapped?
Yeah. Yes.
How old was he at the time?
I'm going to say he was probably around 60 years old. Yeah, probably around, my guess is around 60 years old.
And my impression of how this works, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that in a situation like that, like, there'll be people who, there's like a pretty well-defined network of people who you can negotiate with. If you make a deal with them, they'll actually stand by it pretty well. A lot of people have insurance about, like, around this sort of thing, or at least some people do. Is that right, or am I mistaken there?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I mean, I was very young, and what I read a long time ago. I know that the people that, I mean, it's not known the people that kidnapped. It's not like some drug lord we know did it and wants money for it. It's not that type of person. It's not that type of deal. It's probably some gang that makes their money off of kidnapping people, and they looked at my grandfather was a successful person, a well-known person, and they decided that he probably had enough money to pay up, and they decided to kidnap him. And then what they do is they contact the family and they start trying to negotiate a release or proof of life or, you know, things of that sort.
How long did they have him?
If my recollection serves me right, I think they had him about 4 months.
Jeez.
It was a long time. He was kept in a house. I mean, you can call it a house, but it's kind of like a cabin where you had to hike up a mountain for about an hour or 2 hours. And he was tied to a tree outdoors for a lot of it. He wasn't really allowed to shower, so when the police came to rescue him, his clothes had pretty much disintegrated. He had lost, I don't know, 30, 40 pounds, I don't know, a lot of weight. He was fed pretty much just rice and beans, and he was pretty much treated, as he describes, like a dog. They would just pretty much throw their food at him.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very surreal thing that he went through.
And I mean, must have been pretty conscious of what, I mean, you're old enough that you were, you know, aware of what was going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I remember vividly the next day going to school, because my mother was like, listen, I know you don't want to go to school, but I don't know what you're going to do sitting here. I mean, you know, my whole family was in another town, in another city. You know, you should go to school and try to distract yourself. And I remember vividly just walking around that day, not even knowing if it was real. It just seemed so surreal that could happen to me. I mean, you never think it's going to happen to you, but yeah, it can.
I mean, I'm sure you imagined the worst or feared the worst, but did you have a sense of what the odds were that he was going to come home safely eventually?
I had no idea. I don't think I even thought about that. I'm not sure what I thought about, to be honest. I was 13 years old. I was pretty shocked about it. And I remember just talking to family members and, you know, trying to kind of put on a positive face, but it was, I had no idea what the odds were that he was going to come back.
Yeah. Well, I'm remembering now the story that you told also about your mother being threatened with the picture of you and your sister. Were you aware at the time that that had happened? I mean, did she tell you that you specifically were being threatened?
No, actually, I found out about this not too long ago. I found out about this probably like 3-4 years ago. My sister was here from New York visiting, and she was having a conversation with my mother. And I was like, what are you talking about? And they repeated what I told you earlier about this story. And I was like, you never told me that. And my mother was like, oh, I thought I had. Oops. Yeah, I never knew that. I had no idea.
In the times that you were playing home games in Rhode Island, I mean, were they games like just among your friends, or were they games, you know, run for profit by people who might have been, you know, criminal?
There were really small games among friends. There was I have never really played in a big money private game. Probably one or two, but not on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I was wondering if you might have more inclination than the average poker player to steer very clear of anything involving or potentially involving organized crime.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think the risk is worth, like, the risk of going to a big game in somebody's house or in a private game. I just don't think the risk is worth what you're going to get from it.
That's always how I felt as well. Not that I've had, you know, a cup overflowing of invitations, but I've never really sought out those kinds of games, and I generally turn them. I mean, partly it's like, why are they inviting me in the first place? You know, like, what?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's inviting me, expecting me to be a donator to the game. So that always is an extra concern on my part. It's like, well, what's their motivation for wanting me there at all?
Yeah, Andrew, you're too modest. You're a big celebrity. That's why they want
you. Nate, you are too. Don't ask. Don't be asking all modest.
Yeah, Nate, you've never been to Twin River, have you?
I have. I went once. I was acting on outdated information that the game started at noon. I showed up at noon and I never got in the game. So I played a bunch of 1-2 and 2-5.
Wow.
Yeah. And I met you know, a lot of fine people. So it's
you didn't meet Zeta?
I don't think we met.
No, we didn't meet. I did see you though, and I saw you talking to John the lawyer.
Yeah, now I regret not meeting you. Next time I'm there, I'll be sure to say hi.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's an interesting place, right? I mean, they call it Pequot North, right?
I never actually heard that name, but I guess it makes sense.
It's pretty cramped, a lot of demand. It's fun. There's like the energy. It reminds me a little bit of the boom era in that there's sort of more energy for poker there than the infrastructure can handle. Like, it's just a lot of people who really like poker, and the place is not really built for poker, and it's sort of a crowded mess. But people seem happy to be there. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. I mean, in all poker rooms, there's gonna be people complaining, and you know, there's gonna be a poker player is gonna complain about something. But overall, I think it's, I mean, for me, it's a great place to play. And they recently just expanded the poker room. They added, I think, 4 or 5 tables. So they have a lot more tables now than they did probably when you were there.
Nice. Yeah.
So it sounds like you're chugging along pretty happily as a professional No Limit player. Then no real plans to do anything different.
I do have plans to do something different. It's not that you're wrong. I am very happy doing what I'm doing, but I do think it's important for me to kind of expand my horizons. And I'm actually buying property management franchise, which is kind of another story in its own. A friend of mine who used to play poker started a real estate management company a number of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, and he is doing really, really well, and he decided to franchise, to be a franchisor and sell franchises. So I'm going to be the first buyer of the franchise, and my wife is going to run it at the beginning, and then plans are that if it does well enough, then I can split my time between the company and poker, or leave poker altogether. I'm not sure. That's still a work in progress.
That sounds nice. What goes into property management?
You basically do all the stuff that the owner of a rental property doesn't want to do. You deal with acquiring tenants, evicting tenants if you need to, collecting rents, doing maintenance. You did the phone call in the middle of the night if a pipe breaks or freezes over, so you're the person that deals with all those headaches for the owner of the property.
Mm. I've always kind of wondered at that point, why not just own the property yourself if you're going to be doing all the work anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll be able to buy like 500 apartment units. So. Nor my 5-10 No Limit winnings.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but the idea is that I'm also going to get into investing in some real estate, since I'm going to be managing other units anyway.
Right. So you will at some point probably be owning some of the property yourself.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds like something that could dovetail pretty nice. I mean, I guess occasionally you get like an emergency you'd have to step away from, but just the kind of being self-employed in a variety of ways dovetails nicely with poker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely the reason why there is an opportunity there is because it's kind of a pain to deal with some of these things sometimes, and that's why, you know, that's the reason why there's an opportunity there, because the owners don't want to do it, and it's totally understandable that they don't.
Yeah, and you have the flexibility to do it.
Correct.
Have you played poker with your son at all, or what games does he enjoy?
Not yet. He actually asked me a few weeks ago if I would teach him to play poker, but I told him he's going to have to get a little bit older. I told him when he was really young that my work, he asked me what I do for work when he first started communicating, and I told him that I worked at a donkey farm, and that's what he called it. And that's what he calls it now. He calls it the donkey farm. So,
what games do you play with him?
Well, to be honest, I don't play any like board games or anything like that yet. I think he's too young for that. He's a lot into play bad guys and good guys and you know, pretending with some things and pretend you're the good guy and I have this superpower and what superpower do you have? All those type of, you know, imagination games. I don't really play any board games with him.
Mm. Has he been to Colombia?
He has, but he doesn't remember anything because he was very small. He was very little when we went. He actually got extremely, extremely sick when we were there, and it was really, really stressful because my wife, being from the United States, she's never been in a hospital in a country like Colombia, which is, you know, a non-developed nation. Going into a hospital in Colombia, it's not the same experience you get when you come into a hospital into the United States. So that was a really, really stressful situation for her and for me because he was very, 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 very sick.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, he got through it fine, but it was it kind of put a little bit of a damper on the trip. But yeah, my father met him, and you know, my whole family met him, and we plan to go back there pretty soon.
What do you tell him about Colombia, or what do you want him to think of it?
You know, I just tell him that's where I'm from, where Abuelita's from, and I'm sorry, Abuelita's his grandma and his aunt is from, and I don't really tell him anything. That I think he should make his own. He should make up his own mind when he gets there. You know, I don't want him to. I don't need to put any ideas about it from my perspective, right? I mean, I think he'll know what it's like, and I'm sure he'll love it in his own way when the time comes.
Nice. Well, it sounds like you've got a good setup at the moment with the poker's worked out well for you. It's been working out well for you for a long time.
Yeah. I love freedom that poker. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. You go, please.
I just loved the reason why I play poker is I love the freedom it has given me. I didn't really care how hard it was going to be at the beginning, but and it has been hard at times, but it has given me a lot of freedom and a lot of opportunity to spend family with my wife and my son, and that's all I ever wanted from poker.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten around to?
I don't think so. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, it's been great.
Being so open.
No, thank you very much. It's been kind of surreal talking to you. To you both.
It's nice putting a voice to the face that I've just seen on a Twitter profile from time to time.
Yeah, great. And, thank you so much for having
me. Yeah, I mean, I would love to get to Twin Rivers at some point. I've talked to John a little bit about it, so you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to meet in person at some point.
Yeah, hopefully we'll meet at some point. Absolutely.
All right, well, take care until then.
All right, thank you.
And it was good talking to you again, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I missed it. Hopefully more often now.
Yep. All right, see you later.
Take care.
I've been having some internet problems this morning. This is the third time I've had to call Jose back, but Nate, you're just catching the beginning of it now.
Well, I mean, this is not optimal, but you're still in Montreal playing the W Coupe, right?
I am. Yeah, I'm actually not even in Montreal. I'm in a more mountainy part of Quebec, but yeah.
I see. Well, try not to disconnect in a big pot.
Thanks. That's good. That'll be our strategy segment for this week.